This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers, sponsors of Great Conversation. Welcome to the View from 22 podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, online editor at The Spectator. In this week's issue, we'll be discussing eugenics, Tory tensions over Brexit, and what poetry tells us about 21st century Britain. Now onto our cover story, The Return of Eugenics. It has been denounced as a pseudoscience that led directly to Hitler's gas chambers, but now it's back, according to Fraser Nelson. The word is taboo, but the idea is back in fashion, that you can use science to improve the genes you hand down to the next generation. I'm joined now by Fraser Nelson and Toby Young, The Spectator's associate editor. Fraser, we all know about genetic engineering, but can you really call it eugenic?
Yes, I think you can. There is understandable squeamishness about the word. But if you use science to try to improve in any way the genes passed on to the next generation, then it is, by definition, eugenics. That's what's happening now in certain areas of life sciences. IVF has been possible for decades. That's not eugenic. You simply fertilize the egg outside of the human body, then put it back inside. But when you start to give parents a choice of eggs and screen them for various infelicities, perhaps diseases that are hereditary and you don't want passed to the next generation, then you're taking a step further down the road to designer babies. That step becomes a leap when you deploy the new technology of gene editing. That's when you take a fertilized embryo and see if you can target a gene that you want to replace, and perhaps it's for a disease like Alzheimer's, or perhaps traits for which the parents want to avoid, and then you take out that gene and replace it with something else. This so-called genome editing technology is the cutting edge of science now. I would argue that you should call this eugenics, not simply because it fits the definition, but because it ought to carry the warnings from history of what can happen to this technology if it falls into the wrong hands.
And Toby Young, you've used the term eugenics in your own writing. Should this phrase send a chill down our spine?
Well, yeah, I recently wrote a piece for an Australian periodical called Quadrant, and towards the end of that piece, I discussed an idea that I called progressive eugenics, which in a nutshell was that one way of addressing long-term unemployment and declining rates of social mobility, entrenched poverty being passed down from one generation to the next, would be once we have the technology to discover which embryos in vitro are likely to be very intelligent. And geneticists believe that that technology will come on stream in the next 10 to 15 years. Once that technology is available, I was proposing, sort of half seriously, that it should be made available for free on the NHS to the people at the bottom end of the socioeconomic and IQ scale, so they could make sure, not compulsory, obviously, but it should be made available for free for those people who fall into this category, should they want it, so they can guarantee they'll have intelligent children, because there's an increasingly strong link between IQ and socioeconomic success. And the best way, I think the most effective way to break the chain, if people can get around their ethical objections to this and the associations that eugenics carries, this would be the most effective way to break the chain between entrenched unemployment and poverty and lack of social mobility.
So you would be comfortable with state-sanctioned eugenics?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by state sanction. That sounds a bit like state mandated.
But it is the NHS.
I called it progressive eugenics partly to be provocative.
But if the NHS are involved, I mean, that is...
Certainly, it would be paid for by the state.
And you think the government should encourage, in your model, Toby, you think the government should actually encourage the poor to have more intelligent kids, assuming, by the way, that the poor are rather thick in the first place. I'm not sure I'd go along with that.
Well, it's not just the poor. It would be people who are both poor and who have a very low IQ. And there is undoubtedly a correlation between people who have very low IQs and unemployment, lack of socioeconomic success. And people tend to pass on these disadvantages to their children because IQ has a genetic basis. I mean, I called it progressive eugenics partly in order to provoke an outcry. And I was actually surprised by how little outcry it provoked. Well, so perhaps you're right, Fraser. Perhaps it is becoming less offensive.
It's all the rage now. I mean, one of the things, I will confess to feeling rather uncomfortable hearing Toby there talking about this, the link between IQ and poverty. I'm not quite so sure that IQ is that much of an exact science. I think you can be clever in some ways, but rather daft in others. I'm also not so sure that social mobility is so perfect that the clever rise to the top and that the poor stay at the bottom. I think right now, a lot of inequality can be explained simply by the woeful lack of education given to people who are poor. Bright, but given bad education.
You are running a few things together there. I don't think anyone's suggesting that there is a single gene associated with intelligence. There's no question it is a vast combination of different genes, and discovering how those different genes interact to create IQ and other characteristics like conscientiousness and so forth, all of which are associated with success. That is work that has yet to be completed. I think no one's also talking about implanting modified embryos at this stage. Perhaps some people are, but under my proposal, the plan only was to allow, when the technology is available, pay for a certain couples to fertilize, say, 100 eggs, examine them in vitro, and then see which are likely to be the most intelligent, and then implant those embryos back into the mother. So they're not genetically modified. They're babies that these couples could have naturally if they had 100 children. It's just taking the element of chance out of it.
What Toby discusses isn't futuristic already. You can pay about £400 and be able to take your choice to have your sperm sorted, for example, so you're more likely to conceive a boy than a girl. For about a couple of thousand, you can choose between embryos to see how many of them have got diseases. At the moment, it's diseases. In future, you might be able to choose for other things. But we're very quickly getting into the realm of designer babies. And that is where a lot of people think is morally a bridge too far.
So is this not, I mean, less a sort of political thing, but more just, it will just be the very wealthy will start doing this to a much greater extent.
Well, I think that's the argument. When Fraser expresses his reservations about having the NHS make this technology available for free to the poor at some point in the future.
I have reservations about it being made available to anybody.
Well, okay. Well, I think the counter argument is, the rich, once this technology exists, the rich are going to take advantage.
Well, they already are, insofar as it does.
But they already go to enormous lengths to try and make sure their children end up more intelligent than anyone
and
else's
spend
children.
Vast
amounts of money on education, on early tutors. They'll try anything, even playing Mozart to their children in the womb, for which there's no evidence at all has any impact. Nevertheless, clearly, when this technology becomes available, when you can choose to bring the most intelligent embryo to term and fertilize hundreds of eggs to find the genius baby you would have had by chance, you'd had 200 babies. Once this becomes available, of course the rich will start exploiting it. Maybe you won't be able to do that in the UK, so they'll go to Singapore or Hong Kong where you can. And this will vastly exacerbate inequalities between the rich and the poor. So the only way to mitigate this massive increase that this technology will create in inequality is to make this technology available for free for the very poorest and the most stupid.
I'm not sure I would want my children to be genetically modified. I'm not sure, Toby, if you would want yours to be genetically modified.
I wouldn't want them to be genetically modified, but if I was given the option of having the most intelligent child my wife and I could have naturally, without having to try 100 times, I'm not sure. And yes, it would be our natural child. It would just be the most intelligent child we could possibly have. I'm not sure I'd reject that.
Is intelligence such a wonderful thing? I mean, do you want some little brain box who's going to be boring you about what happened in like 1224? I mean, wouldn't you rather have somebody who's going to be fun? There's so much more to human life than intelligence, and so much more to intelligence than being able to conform to IQ tests.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, I think intelligence is measurable, and for want of a more sophisticated way of measuring it, IQ does a pretty good job. And one of the findings that psychologists have made, and it's pretty robust, unlike a lot of other findings psychologists have made, which turn out not to be replicable, is that there's a very close correlation between being gifted in one area, such as mathematics, and being gifted in other areas, such as visual art, music, and so forth. The notion that we have multiple intelligences, and there's somehow a kind of equitable kind of hand, an invisible hand in the background, ensuring that if you're not gifted in one area, you're gifted in another. That's sentimental hogwash. Generally speaking, those who are most gifted in one area are most gifted in other areas too. So if I was able to select the most intelligent baby composed entirely of mine and my wife's DNA to bring to term, the likelihood is it wouldn't just be a boring brain box. He or she would also be musically incredibly gifted, capable of writing brilliant sitcoms, making me laugh, the life and soul of every party, and so forth. I mean, the notion that there's a link between kind of autism and high intelligence is, again, false. Generally, people who are highly intelligent tend to be the most highly socialized as well.
And Toby is beautifully summarizing the whole direction of his argument, which makes me so uncomfortable, because you can learn to like and love and treasure all sorts of aspects of humanity. And I think that human nature is something that scientists are able to guess at, very rough guesses, but it's not something we should ever try to edit.
That was Toby Young and Fraser Nelson on The Brave New World of Eugenics. Now, on to the latest in the Tory tensions over Brexit. James Forsyth writes in his political column this week about how the party's leadership has got itself in a tangle, and with no obvious Stop Boris candidate, the problems look set to get even worse for the Conservatives. James says the bitterness of any future leadership contest following the outcome of the EU referendum could release as much poison as the political assassination of Margaret Thatcher. Joining James to discuss whether the Tories will be able to recover from such a fight is Conservative Home's Paul Goodman. So, James, can we expect the Tory wars to get worse over the coming months?
I think it is inevitable that they will, because as the referendum gets closer, tensions will rise, especially if the polls continue to show a relatively tight race. I mean, David Cameron thinks that he is fighting for his political life, and I think it would be very hard for him to kind of maintain a kind of restrained tone in those circumstances. I also think the other thing that is adding to the stress and the tension of this referendum campaign is it is now inextricably linked to the coming Tory leadership race.
And Paul, in his piece, James talks about scores being settled over the EU debate. Have you noticed that happening?
I think although the new intakes, the 2015 Tory intake and the 2010 one, are relatively insulated from from this, there's a lot of bad blood going back a very long way. I mean, some of the resentments in the room in this EU referendum debate go all the way back to Thatcher. They go all the way back to Maastricht. They go all the way back beyond. And I suppose what all this proves is that even though these new intakes were young then, were not even born in some cases, Europe has this vociferous power. It's got this ability to tear political parties apart. Used to be Labour at one point, now it's the Conservatives.
And James, in your piece, obviously you talk about the kind of idea of a Stop Boris candidate. I mean, is that looking likely that someone's going to come forward and be able to stop
him? Well, it's the natural progression of things in Tory leadership races that someone emerges as the favourite, at which point they have a target on their back. George Osborne was until recently the favourite, and you saw how much flack he got. Boris Johnson is now the favourite, and you've had, you know, Matthew Paris making the first blast on the trumpet against him. I also think that Matthew's piece shows how Europe does odd things to Conservatives. You know, who would have thought that Matthew Paris would have become a kind of moralising social Conservative? And that is a kind of sign of how Europe gets
into he's quite uneasy about it in his piece, it has to be said.
It's a sign of how this is, that, you know, how this affects the kind of Tory psyche, how it kind of drives people into positions that you never would have imagined them going into.
Yeah, I think you've got to take a step back about this leadership question. I mean, first of all, we don't know when this leadership bout is going to be. It could be as far away as 2019, in which case the names of some of the contenders we're discussing now may be gone. But I think, on the whole, the worse this referendum is for David Cameron, the more soon that leadership election is likely to be. So if Leave actually wins, not very likely, but if it happens, I'd expect David Cameron to go. If it's a very narrow win for Remain, you could get into leadership election country very quickly. If you get in quickly, I think a lot of the names in will be the names we know, people like Boris Johnson being the outstanding example. If it's 2019, the name of the person who runs and wins may be someone we haven't even considered yet.
One of the reasons this has become so personal is that if you set Brexit aside, there aren't actually that many ideological differences in the Tory party today. And that's one of the things. You know, Boris Johnson and George Osborne's speeches at Tory conference last year, they were arguing in very different ways, but they were arguing exactly the same intellectual point, offering the same political prospectus for Toryism. You know, Cameron, Johnson, Osborne, Paris, they are all liberal one nation Tories. And I think that's one of the reasons why this leadership contest is turning quite so personal.
I mean, you talk in your piece about it being a bit incestuous. Do you think that could actually be quite damaging for the Tories?
I think it's damaging for politics at the moment, how incestuous it feels. That, you know, that when you've got Matthew Paris saying, oh, I feel a bit uneasy about this because I used to write a column for Boris when he was editor of The Spectator, and is it right for me to have a pop at him in those circumstances? I think there is a sense that one of the dangers actually for the In campaign, the referendum, is a sense that politics has been conducted with this kind of closed cast, and that the people are just looking in from the outside. But I think it's important to remember that one of the crucial differences with the contest that John Major won in 1990 is that it's the 100,000 or so Tory members who will actually pick the next Prime Minister.
I suppose what's given David Cameron a certain amount of confidence, at least until recently, was that last May, the voices of protest, the voices from the outside, the voices that pitched themselves against the establishment lost. You know, UKIP didn't win a seat. They held one from the by-election, if you're going to pick me up and correct me. I suppose that's the best way of thinking about it. But, you know, the voices of protest didn't really get very far. So Cameron would have been looking at that in the run-up to this referendum campaign. And up until recently, I just thought he might have thought it's going quite well for the forces of the establishment. But now we don't sort of really know. One very striking element of all this, we haven't heard very much from Labour at all. Jeremy Corbyn's position might have been perfectly designed to boost Leave. He's not actually for Leave, in which case the forces of Remain could turn around and say, there, Leave, the duo extremists, you got Farage and you have Corbyn. But equally, he's not really putting any muscle into Remain either. And that's in his campaign is a sort of plus for Leave to be ticked off against the many minuses they face.
And just going back to Boris, because obviously it's been a week filled with people writing about Boris. What happens to Boris if we do stay in?
I think it all depends on the nature of the result. I think that, you know, if Leave gets over 40%, it's not a disaster for Boris. If Leave gets 45% or more, I think it's a good result for him, because in those circumstances, you know, A, Leave would have got close enough for it not to kind of harm Boris to be associated with a losing cause. And also, in those circumstances, the vast majority of Tories would have voted out, I think.
Boris's defence is that he's written and thought more about the EU issue than anyone save Dan Hannan. It's that that's led him to his decision. You'd have to be, a very open sort of person to believe that there isn't some leadership angle in it for him. And it seems to me he is in his way done a bit of a Heseltine. He's not resigned from anything, but he's suddenly flipped. Someone who we all thought would probably come out for Remain has gone for Leave. So all his eggs now, it seems to me, are in the basket of forcing a leadership election as quickly as possible, from which a Leave Tory would be most likely to benefit, given that roughly 2 in 3 Tory members are for Leave.
I think one thing, though, which is interesting, is Backbench was saying to me the other day, and I think there's some truth in this, but if you actually, the people who want to stop Boris, they might actually have, the only person who might be able to stop Boris is someone who actually backed Leave. If you actually look at the way in which the Tory membership is going to split on this question, that, you know, they might have to choose between having somebody backed out might be the only person who can stop Boris, because on the biggest question for many of these voters, you know, Boris would be on the same side as them.
By the way, a further note of caution, I'm not even sure we know absolutely what rules this contest is going to be conducted over yet in terms of the parliamentary stage. It might be the 22 committee has another look at it. I'm not sure we know which two people, if the rules don't change, go through to the final. It's very, very, very hard to tell among what some people call the most sophisticated electorate in the world,
i.e.
one of the most unreliable and duplicitous, to know who they will put through. I don't really have a firm sense of what numbers Boris has got. I think his position is sort of somewhat improved by coming out for Leave. But you've got to remember, this could be, you know, what I'm thinking of now is an Andy Warhol leadership contest with lots of people coming forward who'll be famous for 15 minutes, put their hat in the ring, discover there are no takers for the hat. You could find other people coming forward who suddenly mass a lot of support. I'm not sure we know at all who these two people will be in the final, other than I would gamble that at least one of them will have supported Leave.
And finally, what does poetry tell us about Britain? In an article this week, performance poet Gary Dexter talks us through what he's learnt about the state of the nation from his experiences reciting verse. He's memorised 150 poems and says he has made it his mission to perform great poems to the public. But what has reading aloud Larkin, Wordsworth and Wilfred Owen taught him about Britain today? Gary is joined by fellow performance poet Dean Atter to discuss. Gary, in this week's issue, you talk about how you've been reciting verse in the street of Britain. What is the poetic state of the nation?
It's looking very good, both in poetry appreciation, but also people who are writing poetry. I'll tell you about what I do, my modus operandi, if you like. I go up to people in the street. I'm a poetry performer, so I'm asking them for money. So I have a hat and I ask them for money at the end of it. So I say to them, excuse me, sorry to bother you. Do you have a favourite poet or poem? If you do, I can try and recite it for you from memory. And then if you enjoy it, and only if, I offer my hat at the end for any change you may have. So that gives them time to think about, you know, what poem, because they feel a bit sort of put on the spot at that point. So at the end of that spiel, hopefully they can think of a poem. So they might say, I'd like Kipling's If or something like that. And then I recite that from memory. So people will tend to go for the same poem. So the top 10 would be If is definitely number one. Then you have Stop All the Clocks by W. Jordan, because it was in that film. We've got stuff like Dulce et Decorum Est by Wilfred Owen, This Be the Verse by Philip Larkin, those kind of things. And then it would get more and more obscure from that point on. So I've memorized about 150 poems.
Great. And what do you think has been the most sort of startling discovery during your kind of poetic odyssey around the UK?
Well, apart from the fact that I've had to deal with an enormous amount of people telling me to go away in no uncertain terms, which is quite an interesting way of relating to people. Apart from that, the emotional response that people have to poetry really I didn't expect. People will laugh, people will cry, people will throw their arms around me. We'll have lots of interesting talks about poetry. So the financial aspect of it, which is part of my sort of domestic economy, but you know, only a part. That is not the only part of what I do. It's also to do with talking to people about poetry and finding out what they like.
And Dean Atter, you are also a performance poet, but you, unlike Gary, I think write your own poetry too. How does your experience compare to Gary's?
On the emotional responses, definitely I get that kind of response to from people where they want to talk about the poems, they want to hug me, they want to really just kind of tell me their own stories that relate to the poetry I've performed. For me, it's coming straight from me and it is by me. So it's kind of that is very different, I think, to reciting other poems, because other people feel they own those poems. I've read in your article where you said you recited the poem This Be the Verse with the line, yeah, "They fuck you up, your mum and dad." And a boy actually said to you, "Do you understand the poem?" Which is must be devastating to have memorized something and you must feel passionately about it to memorize it. But for someone else who thinks they know it in a different way to say you don't understand it. People can't do that with my own work.
That was a fantastic comment. And the more I think about it, the more that really resonates. Because I don't necessarily feel passionately about all the poems that I remember because I'm remembering them. Because So in fact, I know quite a lot of poems that I don't actually like very much.
Gary, I noticed that you also do weddings. So is this in the vein of being a magician? Is it something similar in that respect that people are kind of amazed that you can remember this?
People hire me in the same way as they would be a musician or some kind of entertainer or magician. Yeah, so I mingle among the guests in the party and people just ask me, can you give me Mr. Blini by Philip Larkin or something like that? So then I recite it. So I don't recite on a stage necessarily. Just going back to what you said about them being amazed that I can remember it, in a sense, my memory is actually quite average, I've discovered. I had to put quite a lot of work into this, but occasionally I come across people who can remember enormous amounts of poetry seemingly effortlessly. And so I feel quite cowed by some people's abilities in this area. So I'm putting a lot of work into it. I don't know about you, Dean. Do you remember your poems or do you read them?
I memorize my own poems. I find I can give a lot more to the reciting and performing of them if I've memorized them. I love performing as much as I love, you know, sharing my work in publication or online or however I can share it. So different people receive or want to receive poetry in different ways. Some people want to read it on the page, hence why I published a book. But other people love to be performed to and love to have that direct connection with you. And some people like to watch it from the comfort of their own home on YouTube. So you having videos online is quite important for a poet these days to kind of connect with people. Because, yeah, some people don't think they like poetry until someone tells them a poem. They wouldn't necessarily pick up a poetry book. But once someone recites a poem to them, they're like, ooh,
That's absolutely right. In fact, I've got a couple of poems which I've kind of classified as poems for people who don't like poems.
So what are they?
Okay, so one of the first ones is Charge of the Light Brigade, because that's incredible. You know, half a league, half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death, rode the 600. It's an enormously sort of evolving, evocative poem with a kind of galloping horse beats and flashed all their sabers bare, flashed as they turned in air, all that kind of thing. And then another one would be Wilfred Owen's Dulce et Decorum Est, which is an extraordinary, extraordinary poem about the waste of war. And then possibly something like Larkin, the one you just mentioned, Dean, This Be the Verse. Actually, what people sometimes say to me is, if I give you a word, can you make a poem out of it? That actually is it's the bane of my life, because it actually comes from a film called Before Sunrise. So now, because of that film, I have to do this.
Can we test you on that? If we give you the word spectator, what can you...
Oh, God, Okay, spectator. What rhymes with spectator? Hater, haters of spectators. How about there are things worth remembering? There's your mother's whisper in your sulky ear on the first morning of your seventh year. And there are people, there are haters of spectators, the quick spring green of the crowns of the queens of the forests. But the greatest poem is a poor thing. It can only make breath speak to breath. But what could be greater than be interviewed by the spectator and cross death and bring forth tears like cheap gin and snare the sun in a thicket of letters.
That's all for this week. To subscribe to this podcast, visit the iTunes store. And a reminder that podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.